Welcome to everybody. Today I'm going to talk with Professor Thaddeus Johnson. He's a professor of criminology at Georgia State University. Before that, he was a police officer for about 10 years, and he was also a police supervisor. We're going to talk about his path in and out of policing, what took him to policing and out of policing, his research, the George Floyd homicide, COVID-19, police management, and also we're going to talk about the future of policing, what the future of policing looks like. So I wanted to thank you for listening in or watching, and enjoy. Thank you. Hey, thanks. Thanks again for joining me. I just wanted to get started by just letting everyone get to know you a little bit, who you are. Can you tell us, like, where did you grow up?
I grew up in Memphis, Tennessee. I've lived all over, lived some time in Chattanooga, Tennessee, lived some time in Jamaica, and now I'm here in Atlanta, Georgia. So yeah.
Okay.
So originally from Memphis.
Grew up in Memphis, and then yeah. What you were in policing? What?
Yeah, I worked in policing for 10 years down there. That was about 10 years ago, so I'm telling my age, right? So, yeah.
And how did you come? Like, what was your sort of? Because we all have like a path to policing. I have sort of had a path to policing. What was your path to becoming a police officer?
No, it's funny. It was serendipitous of sorts because I was in college, not necessarily taking care of my business, 22, 23, needed to get a job, and just somehow policing came across the map. I was doing security at the university I was at, the campus policing. Kind of grew from there, kind of sparked my interest, got some training, and then came back home to Memphis, and we were hiring down there in Memphis, and so,
Did you know anyone? Did you have any family members?
No family members. And I'm one of those families where, like, we don't do the police thing. I'm not sure if I'm the only person to be a police officer, but I have some people do security, things like that. But nobody's, we've done military, but nobody's really done policing. So that's not a family tradition, not a legacy officer at all. So
okay. So it's not like the family business or anything like that?
No, nothing like that. It's one of those things that got into it, and I actually just fell in love with it. Like, it was one of the things I really enjoy. Got tired of it at a point. That's why I think I'm in academia now. And that was a great experience. I mean, it was a wonderful time. It was my prime, you know what I mean, as a young guy. So yeah, I really enjoyed it, man. It was helping people, and can be quite frustrating, particularly policing where you grew up at, because you're a little bit more emotionally attached. Those things make me stronger, and it really has helped me in my research today. So
what did you do? So when you were, you said you were on for about 10 years. Can you tell us, like, what did you do in the police department?
Yeah. So started a patrol, then I did a little the supervision for a little bit. Then I started doing training. I spent the last probably 3 or 4 years just doing training. So whether it was firearms training, whether it was force, whether we're doing, I even trained certified officers in bicycle patrol. So,
okay.
Yeah. So even things like that, I did a lot of training for part of it, and just really worked special with Vince, but I did a lot of training, whether it was basic or whether it was insert.
And then how did you said you were doing it for about 10 years, and then you got tired of it. Can you tell us sort of, I don't know, if it's not too personal, like what was that part? Because I know I had a long process. It took me like years to make my way out. It was to give up on, because I was on for about almost 10 years myself, and it was like a part of my identity. I had this decent income, and
yes,
it's a big step to take to leave that profession after 10 years. What can you tell us, what took you out of, what led you out of policing?
Well, I had gotten to a point to, even in the job, was just as far as being able to move up. I was kind of at a place where I was stuck. Like, I was probably going to be stuck in there just for another 5 years or so, middle management. And so that was a little frustrating, but also just the job. Like, Memphis is, I think, like 65% black city. So 65% of the people, they look just like me. And so the contacts that you have with those people that look like you, and you understand that they're committing these crimes not because they're bad people, but they're either in bad circumstances, just made a dumb mistake, right, with generally good people. And so knowing that as an officer, what I was doing to that path, even though I was doing my job and society needs that job, but for me, it wasn't the change that I wanted to affect. I wasn't sure if I was actually part of the problem or if I was just, I mean, if you're not part of the solution, you're part of the problem, right? So I just didn't feel like I was contributing the way that I wanted to contribute. I met my wife around that time. She's a big dreamer, right? And so she came down from Brooklyn, and we just kind of started bouncing around and following our passions. And it led us to the doctoral path somehow. I never would have thought, but yeah, so we ended up, and 10 years later, about to defend my dissertation in probably about 4 weeks. So yeah.
I know my wife was a big part of my, because I had wanted to do it and I just couldn't, you know, I couldn't do it. And then seeing her, she went and got a PhD first.
Really?
And then, yeah, and she did it when she was, she was like 40. And so seeing like this mother of two, the working woman who's like, you know, I met her, she worked in a poster shop, you know, like not, you know what I mean? So
yeah,
she worked her way and then went and got a PhD. And I was like, well, if she can do that, and
yes,
you know, like, yes. So it was really an inspiration of, so you kind of had a similar thing where you met this woman and you were kind of inspired by her to.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, it's easier to kind of jump out and make a change when you're not by yourself. You know what I mean? It's a little bit scary as a single person, and you just, you know, it's good when somebody has your back and you all just wanted to do something that's different. You're not sure what it is, but you know that if you travel this path, you'll get there. And it's a lot easier when you have a partner doing it and not doing it by yourself. I'll tell you that.
What was it like? I know for me, it's been like, it hasn't been easy all the time being like in my age and everyone's 25, the grad students, and you go from being this person who has some authority and you have this like identity and this career to being a grad student. What was that like for you? Was it?
I really had in my master's program at the University of Tennessee in Chattanooga, great people that I respected, and they had a heart for justice, and they knew what they were doing. They were sharp people, and then coming here to Georgia State and just being surrounded by these all-stars and people that really have a heart for justice, not just about the research, about what their research means and that science is supposed to impact and benefit society. And so it makes it easy to see people who are successful, people that you grow up respecting in the space, but people see that these are people who have hearts of gold, who have hearts for society, and it makes you buy into it and knowing that you trust them, and you build this trust, and you're willing to be vulnerable, and kind of having that background and playing sports and policing, those quasi-military type of style things. I'm used to rank and file and understanding organizational picking order that, you know, you have to play your role to get certain jobs done. And so everybody was on the same page. And I was just been fortunate to both the master's and the doctoral level. I respect and who respect my opinions, my thoughts, my dreams, my aspirations. And you can see that, you get those papers back with all their red on it. Their red is love, because you know they're invested in the work that you're doing. I didn't find it really hard. I think maybe as an undergrad, I did undergrad. We were in Jamaica. We moved to Jamaica. My wife and I are dual citizens, and we lived down there. And I did my bachelor's degree online down in Jamaica. That was interesting, but I didn't have to be the old guy in the classroom, so it made the transition a little bit easier. So I hadn't really had to deal with that, but yeah.
Okay, and you said you sports. What sport did you?
I just know we're going to be playing like organized basketball. You're playing at least baseball, those types of things.
So okay,
get used to that the coach. You get used to that the person who's in charge, and you get to be a part of a team, and knowing that you can't take the last shot every time. You have to go set the screen. You need to go box out. You need to go set. You need to go pick and roll so another person can score. So just understanding your role in the bigger scheme of things, and it makes it easier for me. That structure really helps me make my transition.
And what are you working on right now? So you made this transition from policing to academia, you got your PhD, you've got a tenure track gig now, you've kicked out some great research. What are you working on right now?
So right now today, I'm working on a series of papers looking at the impact of college education or higher education policies, or whether it's policy itself, whether it's the amount of college-educated officers at the department level and at the individual level. One's looking at the use of force, whether they are more or less likely to pull the trigger, but also are they more or less likely to be involved in like violent arrests and also being involved in physical altercations with citizens. I just finished a piece on misconduct. Not really finding a lot of significant effects with that, but that really kind of goes to show how deep that culture runs, the police subculture runs, and that if you really want to impact change, you're going to have to focus on more than just one part of the tree. It's going to take a full-throated commitment, and even how the leadership to your goals, your mission. So it really points that out. And the last paper is looking at the impact of an education policy on departmental outcomes as far as violent crime, and if police effectiveness, if the impacts of police education works through their arrest rate or their clearance rate, their effectiveness at arrest, if they can reduce or prevent crime. So I'm just kind of playing around those areas right now, along with probably a host of other things. probably doing too much, but I love what I do.
Okay. And I spotlighted some of your research on the very first episode of this podcast with one of my mentors, Rick Rosenfeld.
Yes.
So I'm sorry I let him come on here and explain the work when you were the driving force behind that research.
But he's my mentor too, man. Rick is, it doesn't matter if Rick's the first author or the media author, he is the best person to talk about anything. You know what I mean? So definitely, yeah.
And I was amazed with him as just his nuanced understanding of violence and the history of violence and its role in society and how, it's managed. It's been incredible. So that's kind of like our connection. And the reason I had wanted, initially I reached out to you because I wanted to talk to you about some things I saw happening with the COVID response.
Yes.
And the way that I had seen this sort of trend online with officers. But history has a way of thrusting things on us that, and I talked to you before if it was okay to mention, to talk about this.
Yes.
And I just have to ask for your sort of like, I was horrified. I think anyone should be horrified by what we saw in Minneapolis. Do you have like an initial, what was your initial sort of reaction to that?
So I will say this one was different. It hit a little bit different, right? Because I'm the first. I like to consider myself standing in the gap between, these minority communities and police officers. I've had the experience of both. I walked in both shoes. And so I know how almost impossible the policing job can be. And so I always try to give them the benefit of the doubt because I understand the difficulties of it. However, there was no way to talk around that. That wasn't about black and white. That wasn't about a police officer and a citizen. That was about a person who had disregard for another person's life and a person who shouldn't have the badge. And it really hit home with the racial aspect of it. Because when you think about this COVID season, the disparities when it comes to that, you had a thing with Ahmaud down here in Georgia. So just a lot of things that, particularly with black men, it just really hit a little bit differently this time. And I immediately saw that. I was like, yeah, that guy needs to be fired. He needs to be fired. There was no excuse for that. That's a black mark on all the police. And think about it. We probably have, 25 million contacts with citizens. That's probably conservative every year. And, man, the overwhelming majority go well. They go well. We have great officers, but have that one guy who puts a mark on it, and that reduces and undermines our legitimacy. And so it's bigger than just this one event. It's about just the structure of our society, the trust in our government, the trust that everybody's created equally. So it was much bigger than that moment. That was a flashpoint and just really highlighted, it was a microcosm of everything else that's going on in our society right now.
Can you talk a little bit about what happens? Like, you're an expert on policing. You understand crime. You've studied crime. What does it do to a society when huge segments of the population, their trust in the state and the trust in the police is diminished? What are some of the things that can happen as a result of that?
You can have an increase in violence where we meet a victimization, where we don't trust the police. We don't trust even if we go to them. Because there's some research that shows that, when it comes to outcomes and clearance rates, when it comes to outcomes and cases where sexual assaults or what have you, that minorities and not that non-whites tend to get the short end of the stick. And so with all that and the history, if we can't trust our police officers to keep us safe, what do we have to turn to? And when you have that feeling, that pent-up emotion, when it comes to the heads you have, these events we have right now, I'm by no way condoning it, but what other recourse do people feel that they have, right? And so it's just a tinderbox. And this moment is waiting to happen. I mean, the frustrations are already with the economy, with the pandemic. This is really just a perfect storm, to use probably for a lack of these better terms, but it really damages our society. It takes us back to before the 1960s. I was talking to my father, who grew up in Memphis during that time, and he was on the phone. I was like, man, this is like starting all over again. And so when you take that and look at those historical images and what policing has meant to certain subsects of society, it really damages it. We have no trust, no faith. People's civic engagement will stop. Like, why would we go to the polls and vote if we don't feel our voice matters? Why would we go to the polls and vote for a government that we feel don't represent? And we know how that can turn out if everyone's not represented with their vote. And these are the type of things where people withdraw from the government, withdraw from society. It's not what we want. We want people to be diverse and be together, but it's what draws us, and that creates these subcultures that can breed crime, that can breed this harshness and acrimony between police and the public. And yeah, it's not a good thing.
It undermines safety for everybody. And I know, like, just trust, it has, like, it's not just this on a big macro level, it's like individual people, and there are people who die because people didn't trust the police, and they took it into the matter into their own hands, or they didn't cooperate in the investigation. When I was an officer involved in a shooting, and the victim that I was in defending, I was positioned between the suspect and the victim on a domestic violence call, and I ended up having to shoot the suspect. And one of the major reasons was to defend the victim, but the victim was an undocumented immigrant to the United States, and they fled. So they ran away, and I was, during the investigation, the witness wasn't present because they were scared that Joe Arpaio was going to deport them if they stuck around and talked to the police. So when you create distrust in the government, it not only affects victims, but officers themselves. Their safety, security, their ability to do an investigation. No criminal investigation works without public trust.
Exactly. Like, it's funny you said, I'm working on a piece right now, and what I'm finding is that departments can affect crime rates without depending on arrest, right? And you're talking about it, when you're building that community engagement where, like, you know, now we trust you that we can tell you where this bad guy is because you're part of the community. We know that you're going to go out there, you're going to protect our, keep it unanimous, I mean, anonymous, sorry. And you're also going to make sure that this person doesn't come back for retribution. They trust you. Those things are needed. You have these cities with undocumented workers, you have the immigrants, you have these cities where, like, report the crimes to us. We don't care about your status. We care about your safety. And those are the type of things that really, really, really build the trust. And those are some of the stories that I wish were really out there to kind of at least provide a balance of things that we see right now.
Right, and I know my agency that I worked for, we really, our administrators, they understood the importance of that. So they made a concerted effort to send officers into the community to say, hey, we don't care what your status is. And we made it intentionally, we didn't communicate and try to get them deported because we valued that public trust and knew that public trust was more valuable than some short-term sort of arrest. And I definitely see the similarities here. You're in Atlanta right now.
Yes.
And what's happening? What's happening there right now?
So right now it's pretty calm. I don't hear any helicopters or anything, but this weekend, we live right downtown, and my God, this weekend was just, it was something to see, watching on the news and just seeing the people. We walked up and down Peachtree and just see the windows and all these things, and just you can tell there's a lot of hurt and pain coming down through those streets, and it's just funny. This is one of those civil rights meccas in the U.S. And so for this to take place down here, we've seen a couple of rallies down here since we've been here, since 2016. And so there have been a couple of marches, Black Lives Matter movements, and marches down here, and none of them look like this. And it just really goes to tell you that how fed up people are, how people don't have anywhere to turn. I think we have to get something done now. Like, you can't say we're going to get it done, not get it done, because this is the future of our nation depends on this. You can't get this wrong. And if Atlanta has a response like that, a city that's not known for violent protests, then I know there has to be something there. There's something.
With the, I mean, these protests, I worked on the tactical response units, like the riot squad and my old agency during the Occupy protests. And I remember very distinctly recognizing that the protesters were trying to, like, educate the public. They were trying to convey a message to the public.
Yes.
And one other thing, so you see this sort of, like, the quote unquote peaceful protests versus the quote unquote riots, like, but I'm not trying to make any kind of distinction. What I'm thinking about is that there's been an effort, there's been the destruction of property in an effort to convey a message, as far as I'm concerned. And I'm interested in Atlanta, I noticed that they targeted CNN.
And I'm not sure. I'm not sure why. I just think that it represented is a major feature here in Atlanta. It's one of the things that Atlanta and the government and the city that's cherished down here. And I was thinking that day just represented everything about the it just represented just everything about the government, everything about the media, everything about just all those things. I think that's just in that moment at that time, that was the one way, you know, we can make a message. You know, this is lashing out. They're lashing out. People are, so don't condone it, but I don't condemn it, because people are, what are they supposed to do?
It seems to me like a logical response, given the totality of the circumstances and the desperation that the system has currently created for a huge segment of the population. I'm not surprised at all. And it seems like I don't want to say it's like irrational, but it seems like it's logical that this would happen. And people are behaving the way we know people are going to behave when you put them under pressure. So I don't blame them. I don't blame people either. I would imagine if my life circumstances were different, that I can very easily see myself doing the same thing.
That's that's true. That's true. That's absolutely true. Until you walk in those shoes, at least try to empathize with people. You get a full understanding of it. And matter of fact, we had two Atlanta police officers during the protest. Was it last night or Saturday night? Tased two college students in a vehicle after the curfew was passed, and the chief and the mayor, they fired them. The two officers right there, they fired them. They were like 20-year veterans, and they fired them because they said it was excessive use of force, and they just shown there's no zero tolerance for this type of behavior. And I think that's what's going to have to happen for the public to trust that we will police ourselves, that we have to show a willingness to do it swiftly and fastly, and do it with a certain amount of, I'm sorry, did I
no, something? You're okay. You're good.
All right. I'm an old man, so the technology.
No, you're doing good. It's great.
Yeah, so it's just all those things that we talk about, the Chimer's theory, and we talk about all those things that's needed to show people that, hey, we can trust you all, that you all are an extension of the community. But until these things happen, and listen, for these officers, they might just have one bad moment, one misjudgment. And is it fair? I'm not sure or not, but in this time and place, we can't afford to lose a public trust anymore.
Right. I remember, like, the city I worked in was, the area I worked in, I didn't interact with a lot of Black people. It was mostly an Hispanic neighborhood, mostly a migrant community. Right. So I developed I've found that different cultural groups, you need to develop a certain sensitivity to certain issues and develop a cultural operating system to interact. And so I didn't have a ton of experience dealing with Black people at work. It just wasn't something I had to do it. But when I did, which was, fairly regularly, it wasn't every day, but it was fairly regularly, I noticed, like, I could feel it when I pull, like if I pulled a black man over in a car, it wasn't just me in the car. It wasn't just me and him there. It was like hundreds of years and countless encounters and history that was there with us. And when you have something like this happen, it like rips like a hole in his time. And it like, it's all, it hasn't gone away. It's still there.
It's like, it's stressful, man. Like, I mean, even if, I got pulled over for, what was it, a couple years back, and I remember getting stopped, and I know I don't have anything on me. I know I'm cool. It's all good. I know police officers, but that feeling in my chest, you know what I mean? I couldn't shake it. Even as an officer in uniform, I could be riding the home in my uniform, and I'm going through, to the neighborhood, this Black neighborhood, and see officers having pulled over. I'm torn in my emotions, and so it's just one of those things, man. It's one of those things. It's just it was probably my experience in policing was just a constant feeling of being torn.
I can't imagine. I mean, when you think about the places that you could inhabit and the positions in our society you could inhabit of an identity where you feel torn. Like I can imagine like this, like your experience must have really exposed you to the division that exists along racial and cultural lines in our society. It's been a fascinating experience being an officer.
Yeah, I wouldn't trade it for. I never thought I would in the years. I didn't want to be a police scholar, and it keeps finding me somehow. So,
so what? I know this is an impossible question to answer, but I'm going to have to ask it because I'm curious where it will take you. But what are your thoughts on what happens now? Like, what can be done to create a more just and peaceful society, given where we are now? Sorry.
Well, I will say, and sometimes I say it in jest, but I was like, one way that if we as a community want change in the police department, we need to go and fill out some applications. I think one thing is more community members with this heart of justice to go out there. Look, there's plenty of police jobs out there, right? We have a shortage all over the nation. And so sometimes I say it in jest, but I think it's not just about, you know, about skin color, but it's about those different experiences. So you have members of the LGBTQ community who they're right behind black males when you're talking about misconduct complaints and things like that. And so we need to just have a more diverse police force. But this is the thing. If we don't change the reward structure in policing, it does not matter what we do. If we celebrate arrest as opposed to community engagement, if we celebrate arrest rates as opposed to decreased crime rates, if we celebrate a high number of reports being, I mean, I remember one time the reports in the area, we had a crime in the area. We saturated. Do all these things, and crime goes down. I mean, for several months after it goes down. And we're in trouble because, of course, our constats, it looks like we're not doing anything, but we actually have suppressed crime. So, I mean, how we even look at it, just it has to be completely changed. And maybe complete is the wrong word. That's probably the wrong word. But we need to make a lot of readjustments and some tweaks. But I really think if we reward officers for engaging the community, if we reward officers for being innovative and come up with problem-solving tools outside of arrest. Like, to me, arrest almost represents a failure, right? Because that's the last resort, right? And not a failure on the officer's side, but a failure on society's part, right? And so that's really broad and big. But I really think that if we want to change, it's a whole community thing. But as police officers, we have to show, I can't believe I still talk as a police officer, right? As police officers, we have to show that we're willing to bend. To show that you're willing to make, it's like the spouse of the boyfriend who went out and cheated. You need to come back and beg and show that you're worthy for another chance. And that's what we're doing right now. And I really feel like that by taking swift actions against officers and maybe even having a zero tolerance guidance right now for misbehavior, that's push the reset button, right? To expand our recruitment efforts, to change our reward structures. I think that those are the fundamental aspects of changing. Now, that doesn't get to the broader structural issues that we have in society, right? Mm-hmm. Because if brown and black people continue to be concentrated at disadvantage in these certain urban contexts where police are more deployed, more often because that's just where the services are and where they're needed, right? Still gonna have that problem. And so it's much deeper than the police, but those are things that we can do to show that, hey, we're doing all that we can to show you that we're sorry, to show you that we want to work to show you that we're doing things in our power to move beyond traditional police metrics. I think that will go along.
And I think it's a great point that you make about rewards. I mean, no matter what you do for a living or in life, we're trying to earn prestige. We're trying to earn rewards and we want people to like us. We want to be accepted. And in policing, for me, in my experience, I knew that the best way for me to earn respect in my profession was to identify a bad guy
and
build a case, make a good arrest, serve a search warrant, put him in prison and put him in prison. And that was the ultimate. As I went on in my career, it was getting big numbers. Like that was for when I think about it now at a fundamental level, my ultimate matrix for success was how much of a human being's life that I could send them in and incarcerate them. I mean, they're doing bad things, but it wasn't about, you know, solving social problems. It was about delivering on the things that earned me prestige.
Yes. And look, human beings, right? And we have to make a living, right? I get it. You know, it says, why don't officers stand up and speak out? They should, but it's just not that simple, right? It's not that just, you know, it's that simple. That takes a lot of thought. That takes a lot of gumption to do so. And so you're right, man. If you want prestige among your peers, let alone supervision, you need to go show that you're badass. I can go make an arrest. I don't cut anybody any slack. You know what I mean? And you do those things. Of course, as you get older as an officer, you understand the range of your discretion, right? If you made rank, maybe if you're not, I'm cool, I'm settled. Maybe they can kind of change your mentality. But if you're, man, a young officer coming out and you build a name for yourself, you come out the academy. Well, I come out the academy, I thought every day could be Miami Vice. I said, every day's gonna be Miami Vice, and there was nothing like that, right? But you come out, you're charged, you're energized, you wanna go out there and catch bad guys. But you're not thinking about, like you said, your position in the broader society, what your position and role really is. So even that goes to training. It's not training, different tactics. It's not training more community engagement. That's good. But what is even better is the culture of the training. Like, why are we here? Like, training us through a lens of public service and public servitude and not crime fighters. And I haven't been in the academy in God knows in 10 years, but I doubt that it has changed much, at least in those war stories. And well, this is what you're going to learn in the book, but this is how it is on the street type of deal. It's those type of things that we have to fundamentally change. And you're right. You can recruit the best officers, but if the training perpetuates those old subcultural traditions, if your FTOs are just based on who's been in the department the longest and just we're going to give it to him to get him out of trouble, that's not how you want to bring your officers in. And so you got those fundamental changes that we can do, and it's not big changes. It's lever pulling and it's tweaking and taking these knobs, and we just got to adjust to get the picture that we want. We can do it. Just have to. It has to be full-throated from the top down.
What I've heard you say a couple times about, like, emphasize, and I agree 100%, that recruiting the next generation of people that are going to staff these agencies is it's key, and getting people that, like, again, you said, this people who have a diversity of lived experience so yes. that they can relate to the complexity of what life is like in America. Do you worry? I know I worry about the types of, do you think that the type of person that wants, so like, I think back to the 2008 financial crisis. After the financial crisis, a lot of people didn't want to be bankers anymore because mm-hmm. they had a hard time meeting girls at the bar. You know, it wasn't something that the had social.
Yeah.
When I became an officer, lots of people thought that was a cool job, thought that was a great thing to be. You know, not a lot of people didn't, but it afforded you a certain position in society. Do you worry that given the changing perceptions of what it means to be a police person or police officer, police woman in America, that this is going to change the type of narrow the range of types of people that become involved in law enforcement?
And I definitely even feel like that's been going on for, it's always been a shortage for the last probably decades or so with police hirings. But and this may be anecdotal, but it's just a personal, in my opinion, it seems like it's even much more difficult now to get people to join over these years from Michael Brown and Tamir Rice and all these things because of the stain that's on policing. I do think that if policing wants to recruit this next generation of officer, they're gonna take a look at the Army's playbook. I remember the Army when I was growing up, hey man, they made me in the Army, got cool. They spent money in recruitment. They spent money on commercials. They spent money on community engagement. You had an Army recruiter at every high school, almost every middle school, making sure and just getting them used to seeing a person in uniform and getting used to being part of this team and family. We're gonna have to have a full-on effort and take from their playbook. It's gonna take us to, look, we got millennials coming in. We know that we have to change how we do policing. We have to infuse more technology in there to make it more attractive to them. We're gonna have to give them more autonomy in the context of where we can still monitor our officers, but give them their full autonomy with the changing reward structure to make decisions on the streets. And that's what it's going to have to take. Of course, if you want to get better people, you're going to have to pay more money. And I know that's the economics 101, right? Unlimited wants and desires, but you got limited resources.
Right.
But we're going to have to make those investments if we want to change it. We can't keep recruiting the same people. We can't keep training and recruiting the same way. We can't keep rewarding the same way and think it's going to change. I think in my book, if you keep doing the same thing over and over again, that's insanity. And that's what we've been doing. And so we're going to have to figure out and change with the times. We can't be stuck behind the eight ball because what's going to happen is you're going to have people not want to sign up anymore. You're going to have a police department where everybody's about the verge of retirement, and we need some young blood there. And just you got a lot of young good officers out there. I teach them in my classes every day. These law enforcement is still a position that's still well respected. We hadn't lost that respect as just a profession, but it's marred. And I think unless we keep up with the trends of society, and unless we're willing to bend and just really transform ourselves and be, again, that a cheating boyfriend who, baby, I promise I'm going to change, is not going to change.
And it's, I mean, but I think when I envision a utopia of the future, there aren't any police around, you know, like, I don't think of, like, so I don't want, get rid of the police. I'm all for it, but we do live in an industrialized society, you know, and we're going to need some kind of police force. Yes. So I agree. Let's make a concerted effort to recruit the types of people we want and create. Do you think that it's something, so given where policing in America came from and the roots and the history and all of the scar, do you think that, is it something that can just be reformed, or could it be that there maybe needs to be new reorganization or some, do you think it can be just tweaks, or do you think that the possibility of maybe some type of massive restructuring is something that might be needed?
I think it's tweaks. And for me, it may seem like tweaks, and maybe there probably is massive in the grand scheme of things, but for me, to tweak how you reward people is not different. For you to tweak that, for me to find money out of other places, instead of putting money in all these tactical gear and all these tactical training, let's reallocate it to the type of people that we want and provide them with the tools to be the police officers that we need, right? It'd be great to get police officers that reflected their community, but we've been trying it for years and it's been hard. I think it will increase that. So you need people who are sensitive to the needs of certain communities, sensitive to the needs, like you said, because Black people maybe have one culture and one tradition. Doesn't mean that you have a group of Asian immigrants or a group of Latina immigrants who is not the same across the board. Just like as human beings, we all are similar in different ways, but we have different cultures. It's important that we take those things importantly and not just give me a 3-hour block. I remember I had my training in the police academy for Spanish was like a 1-hour block of patrol Spanish. And I learned all of the cuss words, and that was it. You know what I mean? And so, like, you have to do more than that. Or we're looking at domestic violence. We're looking at a video from 1985. I was in the academy in 2003. 1985 video, they put on for an hour. Like, okay, take this to this 10 question quiz. And you're done. We got to do better than that, right? I'm not surprised having insights that we have some of the issues that we have. I'm not surprised that. It seems like we have plenty of tear gas, right? We have plenty of tear gas and tactical equipment for how many resources we allocate to community engagement. We just have to get our priorities straight. But we can't say we're going to do one thing but not make those investments.
No, and the agencies, I found, I was working recently with an agency and had access to federal money and was trying to direct that money to programs within the department that where it was like positive non-enforcement contacts with kids, like coaching yes. police athletic league, things like yes. this. And the agency turned down the money because they didn't have the infrastructure in place to utilize the funds and didn't feel as though they'd be able to spend it and meet the obligations under the contract. So even when we came along and said, hey, we have money for you to do this, the agency didn't have the capacity because they hadn't developed the institutional skill set.
Yes.
Required to engage.
Yes.
It was remarkable to me because my agency yes. did those things and this agency just hadn't done it. It was remarkable.
Yes. And you're right. So you have to hire the people that you want to bring on that have certain characteristics and traits, whether it be college education, military, diverse groups, whatever it is. Right. And you have to have the training to go along the policing that you want. You have to, again, I keep feeling like I'm harping about the rewarding and things, but these things have to be aligned. So culture doesn't change overnight. And so you're right, it's a gradual thing that we just can't throw money at. It's about a change of heart, a change of mindset. And if any other time in my life, I had like I'm 100 years old, right? Oh, if any other time in my life, right? But if any other time I've been around, I feel the most promise, the most hope coming out of this situation. And I was here when they had the OJ and the racial relations there and the Rodney King. I was young, but I remember those things. The recent things happened in 2014, 15. I've been around for these things, and this is the one time that I feel the most hopeful. And I feel like attention has been gotten. I feel like the good officers are tired of it. They're fed up. We're damn good officers, and our name is Mar, and they're tired of it. And they're willing to speak up, and they realize that change begins with them. And like these police chiefs, look. They know what the answers are. It's just, will the local government support them, right? And these types of things, can they make these unilateral decisions? So we have the right people in place. And I feel like it's a surge coming with like, now officers, like, you know what? these bad officers jeopardize, like you said, the good officers' lives, right? And so you jeopardize in my life, my family's life, and so I just I'm most hopeful. I feel really hopeful about this, and just going to keep telling.
Well, the fact that you're hopeful makes me a little bit hopeful, and I'm impossible to make hopeful, so that's quite an accomplishment. Let me, do you have a minute if I ask you a couple things about the COVID situation?
Sure,
so
sure.
I've noticed I spend way more time online than I probably should, and I've noticed a ton of, and I straddle these two worlds where half of my friends are cops and the other half are academics.
Yes.
And you would think that they're from different planets when they see the same thing. And I've noticed amongst the officers, and then I've seen like these videos online. I'll put a link to a couple of the videos down there in the description of these officers in their full uniform on duty, getting their camera out and saying, you know, officers should not be enforcing these COVID laws. It's unconstitutional. And I just wanted to get you as a policing scholar, as a police officer, former police officer, and as somebody who has been an administrator, can you just tell me let me just give you a hypothetical. So you're a sergeant, you're in charge of a squad. You send all the guys head home for their off days. They come back on Monday, and one of your guys who works one of your beats, pretty good guy, doesn't cause you any problems, good officer or whatever. And you find out that he's got 3 million views on Facebook and YouTube, and it's him talking about how officers shouldn't be enforcing these COVID laws, and he's in uniform and on duty. Can you tell us what that would look like for you as an administrator? What would end up happening to that person and why? Is that too much to ask?
Well, that's a good question, because that's a damn good question. So first, with my law enforcement hat on, just as a pure law enforcement, undermining the authority of the department, of the local government, my authority as a administrator. If you don't have that authority in the police department, I'm trying to think of something more politically correct. I don't want to use the asylum.
You don't have to be politically correct with
but
me.
You don't want to have the inmates running the asylum. And you need that structure, right? Because this is what I found with police officers. They will do, if they feel this fair, they will do what's told. If they feel you're being fair. But what I So the big question is, an officer that did that, would I fire them? No. And I've had difficult officers in the past. And what happens is those difficult officers tend to be the reverend leaders in your departments. So by firing them, you're going to have a lot of supporters, but you're going to have a lot of deserters too. So how do you take this officer and give him consequences, but also utilize him in a way that he can be productive? Right. And so that would probably be my approach. He would definitely probably at least getting written up. He may even get a suspension depending on how bad it is. Because this is the thing about the COVID. I'm torn. I watched the video and I was torn. It's a public health issue. And public safety is police's priority. But when does it infringe upon the constitutional rights? Right? What is our authority? How far does this end and when does it end? That's where that problem comes in at. I do think when you put out mandates as an administrator and you take away complete discretion of your officers, that's when you have problems. And so I think with the whole thing with the COVID and like the citations and tickets, listen, if your supervisor saying, hey, damn, you're gonna go out there and you're gonna write some damn tickets, arrest everybody you see that's violating social distancing, what you gonna do as an officer? You're gonna do it because you got a family to feed, right? And so we can't take officers' discretion away. I would definitely try to find a way to utilize them, whether it's, listen, let's write some policy. Let's start a task force, and I'll make you part of it. Figure out something to use that energy in a good way, but also show them there's repercussions because you have to maintain the structure and integrity of the police work.
Wow, so, that's an answer that made me think about it in a way that I hadn't thought about it.
I should be a politician, right?
Yeah, that's some like jujitsu stuff you got going on there, right there. Putting them to use and not wanting the backlash. It's like what's the art of war kind of stuff going on?
Yeah.
So what do you think it says? So what do you think it says about policing? Do you think it says something about policing that? There seems to be this, like the way that this COVID situation is being viewed, and this sort of, I'm seeing this the strain of like don't tread on me, which is always there, which I always see in the policing community presenting itself more, because I just think of someone going on camera with in their uniform. It's like, I think of it as like an act of rebellion almost. Yeah. That they're very intentional, because officers know that if you go in uniform, you're, you know. Do you think that this do you think it says anything about the state of policing right now, or no?
It shows that we're not utilizing our personnel properly. You have passionate personnel out there who are reform-minded, who may not have all the right answers, but they at least ask the right questions. And so for me as a leader, the first thing I'm thinking, well, if this person's rebelling, why? Why is an otherwise good officer who does a police job well, why are they rebelling? And that's really the core of it, because we're not in the business of losing people, right? We're in the business of utilizing our tools as effective as possible. Now, some departments don't have the leeway and the latitude that I was able to have when I was working, right? I was able to say, you know what, let me reassign this officer here. This officer needs to be working in training. They shouldn't be on the street. They need to be working in training, because we need to have these conversations in training, right? But this needs to be the officer who's our public information officer who talks about things. We find ways and avenues to use them. But that would be my first question. Why are they rebelling? And that's why I said we have to make sure that they get repercussions. Because officers have the right to be frustrated too. You can't undermine authority. And so it would depend on the degree of severity. If they're just pretty much just calling out everything we do and just pretty much undermining everything, that's one thing. You're not part of the team, because that culture is a part of important policing, but it doesn't have to be a negative culture. You know what I mean? That family unit, that trust, those are not necessarily a bad aspect. It's the lean to it that makes it bad. And so as administrator, if my officers don't trust this officer, then that's a problem. So if I can salvage that, that's great. But I'm willing to sacrifice that one sheep for the other 99. That's just me. You know what I mean? If it comes to that. But I want to try to keep them all in the fold, because that's good for morale, because officers will say, wow, they treat us fair. They give us a second chance. They know that we're human. They know that we have bad days. I'm committed to this place. I'll take a little bit less pay. I'll sit in a position longer because I believe in them and they got my back. So these things are much bigger than on the surface implication can be, but can't have officers undermining completely and having total disdain for the badge. If it's disrespectful to the badge, and not even the department, to the badge, then of course it's fireable. But if it's just a rebel, like, let's use that energy and let's see where it's coming from. It's coming from somewhere.
And it does, I think people would be surprised who haven't worked in a police department to realize that there are, I called them shithouse lawyers when we were, because it was the officer that knew all these policies and knew how to cause trouble without getting in trouble.
Yes.
That their power is not necessarily all in the hands of administrators, and there are people with influence within a department, and you can't walk in and just say what you can't just come walk in and run the show however you want.
Exactly.
We had a boss who just got promoted, came to the squad, and he was being way, way, way too, he took away our ability to make decisions. He was a micromanager, and it got to the point where it became a problem. So we all banded together and met in a parking lot at 3 a.m. and decided that we were not going to say anything in briefing, anything, unless we were asked a direct question by him.
Yes.
And not going to talk unless by the end of that shift, I was the senior guy in the squad. We'd already had a big powwow because he called. He's like, immediately after brief, he's like, text me, we got to meet, you know, and we were able to sort it out. But it was the rebellion that led to the communication.
And it came from somewhere. It just went out in error. You're right. Exactly.
We needed to have some kind of like, because workplaces are not democratic, you know, you don't, but you need to have some kind of say. So yes. It's very complicated. And I really appreciate you providing, because when I saw this, I was like, oh, you can't have them going out saying the state, they can't do that, just get rid of them. But I never really, probably because I wasn't an administrator.
Yeah, and it's funny, I just shared one last story. I remember I was 25 and I became a shift commander, 25. And I remember I went in, and so I'm young, this is a young black guy with a mohawk, right? And the first thing I did was I pretty much put everybody your personnel files, anything that's not misconduct, anything else, You have a clean slate. If I don't personally train you, I can't hold you accountable. So I increased the training for my unit. I gave them a clean slate as much as I could, whether even it was just symbolic, right? But now you know that we got structure now. So you screw up, you get a verbal reprimand. Now we can go up that chain and the order, and everybody feels that it's fair because you've been given a second chance. And these are the things that don't cost money. They don't cost money. Just cost a little heart, a little thinking, and a little innovation. And that's how you can get that buy-in, and that's how you use your officers and you retain them, because you don't want to take an officer you invested money into that has this experience, this wealth of knowledge. You don't want them to go somewhere else. You want to keep them, and you want it to blossom and want them to grow there, right? And that's what you want to do, because, again, it is an industry, and we have to. My wife told me, she said, you're not leading goals and objectives. She said, you're leading people. And when she told me that, this changed my whole perspective of how I look at things. And so if you focus on the person, goals and mission will fall probably better than you.
Well, given the crisis that policing is facing, like right now while we're talking, I really wish that you were still out there leading a squad or whatever. I know you're in the middle of an uprising right now, and you're outside your windows, and you're busy, and you're making this transition to this job, so your time is limited, and I really appreciate you taking the time. But I wanted to give you, before I let you go, I just wanted to give you one last sort of window. Do you have any, given what's going on in the country, given what's going on in the world, do you have any sort of final thoughts for people that might be listening to this?
Yeah, I just let me say this for the everyday civilians. The job of a police officer is hard. We have so many contacts with people that go well. We're doing it as well as they can with the resources that they have. Is there room for improvement? Yes. Should our rights be infringed upon? No. But it starts with community. But police departments, we have to take the onus. We have to show that we're that cheating boyfriend, and we want another chance, and we're willing to spend that money. We're willing to engage, willing to go out and do those things we said we wouldn't do, just to show you that we're worth it and that we want this to happen. So everybody's holding together. Tom, what you're doing is amazing work. I appreciate what you're doing. I look at your posts sometimes, and I look at your discussion boards on Facebook, and I see the dichotomy of your friends, and I love the stimulating conversation, because that's what's needed, because we have more in common than we even know. A lot of times we're saying the same thing, we're just looking at it from a different angle. And so just, man, keep doing what you're doing, brother. I appreciate you. Thank you for having me. This has been, I had a wonderful time on it.
Well, thank you so much. And I want to thank you for, because you said you're standing in that gap, trying to bridge these two different groups. I really appreciate the work you're doing. And America, like, the American police, they need to get down on their hands and knees and crawl in and say sorry, because they've done messed up. This is bad, bad, bad.
Yeah.
And like you said, the cheating boyfriend, they need to beg, because
yes,
they're in trouble. Yeah.
Yes.
Thank you very much.
Yes. Have a good one. Brother.